So how was the trip? Did we talk about this publicly? I don't know that we did. Are we talking about this publicly, whether or not it makes the show?
The only thing that made the show is the walkie-talkie bit.
Okay.
Where John was making fun of me for buying walkie-talkies for a road trip.
Yeah, I do want to hear about that, but not this minute. But how was the other parts of the trip, just out of curiosity?
No, I ate way too many combos.
Did you enjoy all your good roadside coffee, or did you bring a gigantic thermos of good coffee with you?
I brought a five-gallon jug. Oh, you're going to make so much fun of me. Have I mentioned this before? I have a monthly subscription to a fancy hipster instant coffee thing from San Francisco.
Why?
I get 8 little tubes of instant coffee powder a month delivered in a little canvas bag, and they cost like $1.50 each. And it's a subscription, and it's instant coffee. You dump it into water and it makes good coffee. It's basically a really good version of instant coffee, and it turns out instant coffee got popular for very good reasons. It's pretty damn convenient when you're traveling. You know, like on the plane, I got a cup of hot water, please, and I got a hot water cup, and I dumped my coffee into it and stirred it up and had my like insufferable hipster coffee right there on the plane. It was wonderful.
You would.
I'm so sorry. For anybody who cares, it's Sudden Coffee. That's the name of it. Because it's not instant. It's sudden. Ha ha.
Oh, my
God. It sounds like it surprises you. You go to drink a cup of water, and all of a sudden, it's brown and bitter. What the hell? It's Sudden Coffee.
Holy shit. It's coffee.
Whoa. How did that get there?
Where the hell did this come from?
Anyway, it's not cheap, but it's pretty good. If anybody needs this kind of thing, it's pretty good.
That's pretty much your motto. It's not cheap, but it's good.
This is why, like anybody listening is probably like, of course I have that. Like, it's this yep. surprises.
This is
nobody.
Surprising. This is surprising.
I thought you were going to say you had like the underscore kit where you have this entire bunch of paraphernalia that you'd take out in the car, including a little table, a lap desk to set it all up on, and then plug in a kettle into the 12-volt socket in the car, and just, you know.
I used to do that kind of like fancy, you know. I brought my AirPress on a couple of trips, and it was just such a pain. I got like a travel grinder and everything, like, and I found it not worth the hassle. And so instead, I would just drink tea on trips. I'd bring my own fancy tea bags, but I don't like tea that much, and you know, coffee's better. And so I found this, and I decided, oh, you know, even though it's a subscription which I don't like, I'm like, well, I'll try it, I'll see how it is. And it's been good enough that I've kept it up. Like I use it. I don't always use it regularly. Like sometimes, like I'll accumulate a couple extras that I haven't used in the last month. But it's fantastic for road trips.
Sometimes I'll just tear up one of those tubes and dump it in his mouth. He doesn't care.
I actually did that once.
Okay,
I was on a road trip and I didn't want to stop to get like a cup of hot water because like there was no good place nearby to do that. So I just kind of slowly ate the crystals.
Oh my god.
Tasted fine. It's a little strong.
That's really sad. Someone draw a comic of that. How come people never draw comics for our show? Someone needs to draw a comic of sad Marco eating the instant coffee, hipster instant coffee out of the tube. Maybe a tear going down his side of his face. Yeah,
driving on the Long Island Expressway.
That was another reason for a tear. Yeah. Stuck in traffic.
All right, let's start with some follow-up. John, tell me about Breath of the Wild on the Wii U.
Last week, why were we talking about it? Oh, we were talking about bitness of consoles was one of the Ask ATP questions, and I was talking mm-hmm. about how power still makes a difference in the modern era, and talking about a game like Breath of the Wild, which is a large open-world Zelda game, and how you couldn't play it on a less powerful console, and I said the Wii U, and I should have just said the Wii, because obviously, in the grand tradition, I guess two data points makes a tradition, of Zelda games that are initially developed for one console, but take so long to get done that the second console comes out and then they launch it on both consoles simultaneously. That was the case with Breath of the Wild. It was actually developed for the Wii U and only later launched on the Switch. And that happened with Twilight Princess for the GameCube and the Wii. Although Twilight Princess, I highly recommend playing it on the GameCube, not on the Wii, because the motion controls are not very good. So a surprisingly small number of people sent in that correction, but to the people who did, good job.
And to everyone else, John is disappointed in you.
Yeah, seriously. You know, pretty big gaff in the grand scheme of things. If it was maybe if it was about like Apple stuff, we would have got more people.
Half of the internet wrote in to tell us that the Space Gray keyboard, mouse, and Magic Trackpad are all available separately now, if that's your cup of tea. I am currently fondling, touching a Space Gray keyboard, and I have a Space Gray magic mouse next to me, and I have a Space Gray Magic Trackpad that I use from time to time. These were all secondhand from friend of the show, underscore David Smith, who did not charge me a premium. However, Apple will charge you a $20 price premium because Apple.
Yeah, why is it that the dark ones? I mean, technically they could do this with any color. Let's just make fewer of them and then charge more because they're more rare. Sure, you could do it all the time, but in general, Apple doesn't seem to do that with things that come in colors. Like, you can get your phones or your iPads in various colors, gold, rose gold, space gray. Sometimes they come in black, but there's no price difference between the colors. And yet somehow in the Mac world, every time something gets a darker color, it's an extra $20 or something. And I don't know. It, for some reason, it bothers me that you can get iOS devices in different colors for the same price, but in the Mac side, that's not the case. So anyway, I just hope if you're out there listening to this, you didn't buy a Space Gray iMac Pro keyboard for $1,500 on eBay, because that would have been a bad move.
I kind of feel like my iMac Pro is less special now that these are available to anybody.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, well, you know, listeners of the show would have been well warned. Because as soon as the iMac Pros came out, we were surprised that it wasn't our prediction that they wouldn't sell for a lot on eBay, because people would realize Apple's just going to introduce them and then your things will be worthless. But alas, that's not the way people think. And so some people did buy them and sell them, apparently, for very high prices on eBay. And I hope all those people are sad now.
Wow. Snarky John tonight. Is everything okay?
And the people who sold them aren't sad.
That's true.
Yeah, I guess. Well, they should be, because they took advantage of somebody. That they feel bad about that, right?
Only if Apple should now feel bad they're charging $20 more for no reason.
$20 premium is better than like a $1,350 premium.
We are sponsored this week by Jamf Now. Jamf Now helps you set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices on demand. You can start a free trial today at jamf.com/ATP. That's jamf.com/ATP. It's pretty easy to keep track of your own Mac, iPad, and iPhone. You know, if you have your own, it's personal, that's fine, that's easy. But what about if you have an organization? What about other Apple devices in an organization with employees? As a business grows, it gets harder to manage everyone's iPad, iPhone, and Mac. This is especially true if you are a distributed geographically, where you have employees in different locations. With Jamf Now, you can check real-time inventory, you can configure Wi-Fi and email settings, deploy applications, protect sensitive company data, and even lock or remote wipe a device from anywhere. Jamf Now manages and protects your device so you can focus on your business instead. And it's super easy to use. You don't need to be an IT expert or have any kind of complicated setup or any experience whatsoever managing this kind of stuff. Jamf Now is so easy to use, anybody can do it. You can start securing your business today with Jamf Now by setting up your first three devices for free. You can see how it is, try it out. You can add more after that for just $2 a month per device. So go create your free account today at jamf.com/ATP. That's jamf.com/ATP. Thank you so much to Jamf Now for sponsoring our show.
I would, at this point, plug our live show that is going to be happening at WWDC on Monday night, but it is sold out. So if you happen to have a ticket and know you won't need it, please get in contact with AltConf and let them know that, or tell a friend or do something. But we have no control over attendance. We have no sway over wait lists or anything like that. So thank you to everyone who has purchased a ticket. We hope to see you there, and it should be really exciting.
You could win one from a friend in a game of chance.
I'm assuming this is a reference I'm not aware of. Anyway, all right. So, Marco, you went on a really long road trip recently, and you had mentioned briefly in the last episode that you had bought some walkie-talkies to take with you because it was going to be a multi-car caravan. The last I tried to use walkie-talkies, which was just a handful of years ago, they were promised to work for like 34 zillion miles and worked for about 34 feet. So, tell me about your fancy. I'm sure you bought the most heinously expensive walkie-talkies you could find. Tell me how well or not well they worked.
So they were only, I think it was something like $60 or $70 for a pair. and that included all the accessories, like the charging base and everything. So I wouldn't say that was that expensive. It's some kind of Cobra. If you look at the Amazon, like the Cobra model that is the highest of its group, that's the one I got. It's like something like that for a pair. And it's the one, it has a very useful feature. This is one of the reasons I went to this model, that it has a repeat that back button. So it keeps a buffer of the last few things that were said. And so if you miss what somebody said, you can just hit that and it plays it again, which is really useful. anyway, John made fun of me relentlessly for buying walkie-talkies for the purpose of communicating between two vehicles on a road trip because we have cell phones. And that was a really good argument. Cell phones do sound way better. Unfortunately, it takes a little bit of time to create a cell phone connection. You have to, you know, pick up the phone, unlock it if it's not unlocked, tap something, find them, you know, connect. A walkie-talkie, you literally just push a button and you immediately can say something to them.
I told you, you should have had your phones connected the whole time.
Yes, but we were like listening to music and podcasts and stuff the whole time with our phones.
Yeah, you mute it. And when you want to talk, you hit the mute. It's not like you're browsing Twitter on it. Bounce it on the dashboard, hit the mute button. Mute, 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 unmute, mute, unmute.
No, but...
yeah, I can't even say it.
But the phone was being used for the media, so that's no good.
Well, what were you... what media? Oh, the podcast?
Yeah, podcast or music or navigation directions. We were also using Waze to navigate.
You can do all that at once on your phone.
Nope, you can't play media while you're taking a phone call.
No.
Anyway, so... and also, where these really came in handy, besides the incredibly fast ability to just push a button and say something quick, like hey, watch out, don't merge left yet, or something like that, or you don't want to stop at this exit, you know, really quick stuff. But also, not the entirety of our trip had cell phone coverage. Because we were going to a very rural place at the end of the trip, the entire last, like, 45 minutes had no coverage, during which we were on the walkie-talkies a lot to coordinate things like where we were going to park this giant truck and how, like, what direction it had to face, how we were going to get it that way, what we were going to do once we got there, how we were going to, like, do the very first steps to unload it and all the logistics involved. They proved to be invaluable. Everybody involved in this trip was very, very happy that we had these walkie-talkies. They were wonderful in ways that a phone either would have been worse or would have not worked at all. So John was totally wrong. And to answer Casey's question, the range, I did a little bit of research, obviously, when buying these, and it appears most of them seem to quote a range of somewhere between like 10 and 50 miles. And it doesn't take that much digging to realize that that's actually like, if you're like two people on top of mountaintops with nothing right in between you, that's like the most ideal scenario of like nothing obstructing it, you know, no interference from anything. If you use it like in like a more realistic location, like in a town or on a highway, the mileage basically gets cut to a tenth. So it gets decimated, right? That's what that means. So your 37 mile one is actually more like 3 miles. And even that is like, you know, if you're in a really dense area, like, you know, in like a city with lots of buildings and everything, it might be more like 1 mile, you know, or maybe even a half mile, you know, worst case scenario for these bigger ones. And there's a limit on how powerful they can transmit, which I think on most of the bands is 2 watts. So that's kind of what limits like how powerful they can be. But yeah, so it was fun. It was totally worth it. And they're really, you know, modern useful things like the playback feature. They both can charge via USB or take AA batteries, or you can put rechargeable batteries in them and charge them through the USB ports. It's great. So John was wrong. The end.
So just for the young people listening, I want to assure you that it actually is possible to take tandem car trips without either cell phones or walkie-talkies.
Yeah, but it sucks.
It does suck. I would agree with both of you.
It's fun. You got to come up with systems for signaling and then get frustrated while the people don't follow the systems for signaling.
That's a John statement if I've ever heard one. My word.
It is fun, though. It's like being a spy.
Something like
that. If I put my right hand out the window, that means pull over. Put my left hand out the window, that means merge.
All right, we should get to the actual topics for this evening, and something happened on Tuesday, and something education. Moving on, let's finally get to the topic we all want to get to, which is Apple's heyday.
There's one in between that you skip, but now we're going to talk about the Tuesday thing. We're not going to go through the event blow by blow because there wasn't that much to go through. But
I thought this was so funny because like last week, we, as professional podcasters, completely failed to mention our WWDC live show, and also that there was about to be an Apple event that we all knew about, and we're like, oh, like everyone else is doing predictions and at least mentioning this is going to happen. We completely failed to even mention it.
I don't think we failed to, because I knew about it. I just didn't think there was anything worth saying on the last show. But I think we talked about it beforehand, and like, well, you know, we'll see what they announce. But until they, like, I didn't have high expectations of what they were going to announce, and so I didn't really feel like it was worth discussing until they announced something.
I mean, I didn't have high expectations either, and they even failed to meet those. I thought it would be really funny if we just never mentioned it at all, because it was, there was so little really to it, but unfortunately John wants to talk about it, so we're going to talk about it. But just pretend like we never actually mentioned it, and it's funnier that way.
There wasn't a lot of product announcements, but I think there are things to talk about though. So my first question is, did you two actually watch the event?
Nope.
Not live, but because it was actually during the road trip that I was taking, but I downloaded the video and watched it that night.
So Casey's poo-pooing this event. He didn't even watch it. How do you know? they could have had seven slides about you.
I have to admit, I also fast-forwarded through some parts of it, because it, you know, what I didn't like about it overall, it kind of made me feel, I don't know, it was a little bit off-putting. It basically seemed like they were holding an event to almost like yell at the world, like, no, look, we care about education, but without actually backing it up with what I consider to be enough. And that could take lots of different forms, and you could disagree or agree with that, but I felt like the premise of an education event that, you know, like that's you know, they call the press out and everything. And by the way, if I was like an independent journalist who flew out there on my own dime to cover this, I'd be pretty annoyed, honestly. But anyway, and I'm friends with some of these people, and they haven't told me this behind the scenes. I'm just saying, like, if I were one of these people, like, you know, that's, I would be annoyed that I had spent the time and money to do this. But the impression I got from this event was that it was a lot of cheerleading. It was almost like a pep rally for Apple and for teachers.
How accurate, given it was in a school.
Yeah, right. but without enough substance, I thought, to back that up. It was really more like, look at how great we already are at the things that we are already doing. Not so much, here's some, you know, new software, new changes, new hardware, whatever it is. Like, there was actually very little of that, at least very little of relevance or of significance. And there was just a lot more like, here's how great we are. Here's someone else to come out and tell you how great we've been and how great we're going to keep being. And it was a weird balance. I just felt almost like my attention was taken advantage of.
You're waiting for them to get to the product announcements?
No, and like, and look, I wasn't expecting like an iPhone or anything. Like, you know, I knew that it was a focused education event. That's one thing. But if you look at, like, you know, what people would reasonably expect out of a, you know, publicized press event regarding Apple and education, I would have expected a lot more than what we actually got.
Some people were tweeting, I forget when it was, like the 20 or 30 minute mark. They were like, we're 20 minutes in and they still haven't said anything about any products yet. You know, there was like a long lead in and there was a long lead out as well. I don't remember the last education event, but another thing people were tweeting about was exactly how long ago the last education event was. Apparently, they don't even have these things every 2 or 3 years. There are long gaps between the events. Having a dedicated education event, Apple does stuff education related all the time, but having a dedicated event for it doesn't happen a lot of time. I think the last time we talked about it, these stats were similar, but to frame this to like, why is Apple having an education event? Why are they spending an hour on stage telling you about all the things that Apple does related to education and trying to make them seem, to Marco's point, as, you know, as good as possible, seem desirable, seem like that Apple is doing great things in education. This is a quote from Bloomberg, a Bloomberg article, link in the show notes. Chromebooks accounted for 60% of laptops, tablet, and other mobile computers shipping to U.S. K-12 schools in the third quarter of 2017. Apple's iPads accounted for 12% of those school devices, which is less than half its market share from 2014. So from 2014 to 2017, their market share has been cut in half, more than cut in half. So not only is Apple not leading in market share in this education category that they're addressing here, which is basically United States K-12 schools, not only are Chromebooks eating their lunch there, but it's not as if that's just the status quo. It's like, yeah, well, you know, Apple's never had big market share, but they have the important market. In 3 years, their small market share has been cut in half. So if I were Apple and I cared anything about education, I would have to be taking a hard look at this and saying, should we get out of the education market or should we do something? Because unlike lots of other markets where we have small market share, but it's steady and we, you know, reap most of the profits, right? Like the phone market, for example, Apple does not dominate the phone market share wise, but I, you know, Apple is probably not crying over that because they make so much money on it and they are seen to have, you know, if not the best phone, then one of the best phones, right? And I don't think you see a lot of articles anymore saying Apple needs to up its phone market share or they're going to be doomed, or, you know, Android is eating Apple's lunch in the phone market just because the money talks, right? You look at where all the money goes, it goes to Apple. And also, if Apple's phone market share had been cut in half in the last 3 years, I think there'd be a lot of articles about that. So I feel like the context for this event is Apple trying to figure out how to even just stay in the game in education. Forget about here's how great we are, but just can, you know, is this a market where we can make a difference, where we can be a player, where we can be important? And that got me thinking about how the education market is different from the phone market or the personal computer market or the TV connected puck market or the home cylinder that you yell at market or whatever, you know, the the fancy computer watch market. Lots of like lots in the modern era, Apple has been all about making tons of money selling relatively high margin expensive products to a minority of a market. The phone market is the best example of that, because they make so much money and their market share is so small, compared to the aggregate of all their competitors, which is always just lumped together as like Apple and non-Apple, basically Android and iOS. But they just make so much money. It's like, well, this is a winning strategy. We don't really care. We're not going to worry that, oh, we need to make a netbook. Remember the netbooks, little cheap laptops to compete with the PC space. We need to make a super cheap iPhone to compete with Android. That's not how Apple plays the game. They want to sell to the best part of the market, best meaning the part that is the most lucrative, the part that allows Apple to make the fanciest products because the people will pay the highest price and the highest margins and it will let Apple's products look nice and everything like that. And I was thinking about whether that strategy is viable in education, because as far as I can tell, Apple continues to essentially pursue that in these past decade or so in education, saying we're not going to have the majority of the education market, but we'll have the quote unquote best part of the education market. The richest schools will buy Apple stuff. Like I'm trying to figure out what they're thinking. That if you can afford us, we give you the best school experience, or it will seem the fanciest if you buy Apple stuff. And for some reason, when it comes to education, that rubs me the wrong way more so than smartphones, just because education I think of more as a thing that has to be for everybody, whereas smartphones, there are options, and if you don't have an iPhone, you are not disadvantaged in life versus if you have an Android phone, right? But if you don't have an education or don't have a good education or your education is not as rich as someone else's, that feels, you know, inequitable to me. And so I'm watching this presentation and I'm trying to figure out, is Apple changing course here? Are they saying we're going to figure out how to let more students get access to our products? Or are we still concentrating on providing the best products for the few students who are lucky enough to go to a school that can afford them? And the presentation, as I read it, as someone who is not, you know, I'm not involved in the education system, but I do have kids in school, seemed to me that they were not changing their strategy, that everything they presented was beautifully polished, sort of very sort of high-end, nice to look at applications, hardware, and software that a few schools are lucky enough to have, but that the pricing was the same as it's ever been, and that nothing they announce is going to help them compete with the things that are currently eating their lunch in the market, not just on price, but from what I understand from people in education, a lot of the features that for the stuff that Google offers are better than the feature that Apple offers. That's why part of the announcements are, yeah, we have a product, a new iPad, but we also have a bunch of new software, that's playing catch up to our competitors to say, oh, here's an easier way to manage a bunch of iPads. Here's an easier way for a teacher to manage a bunch of students doing things. But even that, even the catch up software, I saw a lot of complaints saying, okay, but you still haven't caught up entirely to the functionality offered by Google in terms of integrating into other school system things and providing a broader set of functionality, which may not be pretty and fancy and have like the Apple Pencil support and, you know, high-end video production capabilities so kids can make cool videos about gravity and stuff. But practically speaking, when it comes to, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic and the basics of functioning in a school and having a lot of students and a lot of devices and managing it all, that still, Apple's offerings aren't even the best, and they're certainly not the cheapest. So I'm kind of confused slash concerned about Apple's approach to education, because it seems to me that if they really want to make a difference in this market, they need to pursue a different strategy, because I don't think it's appropriate to pursue a strategy like they do in the consumer market in education. But, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong about that. I would love to hear from people in education who have worked with Apple and Google stuff about how they perceive these competitors. That did people watch the education event in you know, people who are actually teachers or school administrators and think that Apple had done something that's going to change the game, or did it just seem like more of the same?
I thought Joe Saplinski had a few good tweets about this, and I'll probably forget to put them in the show notes. But Joe used to be I think he was an English teacher, if I'm not mistaken. Apologies if I have that wrong. But now he's an app developer and designer and slash rock star. But in any case, you know, his take about it was, you know, look, Apple doesn't really play the, you know, cheap game, just like you were saying, John. You know, it's not Apple's card that they play. So are we really surprised that this is the way this event turned out? And, you know, he and I went back and forth a little bit in a happy way, or at least I thought it was happy. Maybe he was annoyed at me, but, you know, we went back and forth a little bit. And the thing that, you know, I've not worked in education, but Aaron was a teacher, a high school teacher for a long time. And in fact, and I think I've mentioned this a few times on the show, a few years ago, actually many years ago now, there was national news about like a stampede that happened because iBooks were being sold for $50 a pop at the Richmond International Raceway. And they were old, like high school iBooks that were being retired. And so they were selling them obscenely cheaply. And people like got trampled trying to buy these cheap iBooks. Well, that happened because of the county in which we live. It was our county that was selling all those. And so Erin, when she was teaching, the kids all got issued Dells when she was teaching. And
dude,
it was just you're getting a Dell. It was just a couple of years before that they were getting these iBooks, etc. So having, you know, spoken to Erin about this, I mean, again, I'm still a little bit removed from the actual decision making, as was she, but it seemed pretty clear to me that even in a relatively affluent area like we're in, I mean, we're no, like, you know, Greenwich County, Connecticut or anything like that, but we're not, you know, broke around these parts. And even here, it's all about cost. It's just 100% about cost. And so, yeah, I think you're right, John, that maybe the Apple's play is, hey, if you happen to live in a really rich area, or if you go to like a very well-to-do private school or something like that, then yeah, we have all sorts of sweet answers for you. We have a sweet solution for you. But I don't know of any, like, quote unquote, regular school system that is going to look at anything more than initial purchase price, maybe total cost of ownership, maybe. But generally speaking, it's going to be purchase price. And the other thing I've gleaned from Bradley Chambers and Fraser Spears and a few others is that apparently the management stuff that Google has is way better than what Apple has. It's not even in the ballpark. Now, to be fair, you can supplement what Apple does with like Jamf or other third-party tools, but it seems to be a lot more work and a lot more money to use the Apple suite. Is that worth it? Maybe. They certainly painted, from what I've gleaned from not having watched the event, they certainly painted a pretty compelling picture as to all the things you can do with iPads in the classroom and so on and so forth. But I just don't see how that's a realistic play for almost any general school system in the world. And if you're going to spend $330 on, you know, per kid on an iPad, I got to imagine in aggregate that adds up to a not insignificant amount of money. And the first place I would put that is teacher salaries, because at least in America, salaries are just hilariously, just devastatingly small. And it's absurd how little teachers get paid here.
That gets to the other point that is less and less mentioned, I feel like, in the modern Apple era, which is general skepticism about whether the addition of technology actually improves education. To your point, Casey, about maybe if you actually paid teachers more, that would improve education more than buying all the kids a laptop. Like, there is a technology angle that Apple can speak to, which is they have a very important profitable platform that, if things keep going well, will be a viable place for children to make their living. And so teaching coding skills, and just more broadly, teaching coding skills, which is the thing that Apple's familiar with because they have a developer, you know, they have developers, they have developer relations, they have developer tools. They are well equipped to make an education-focused version of teaching people how computer skills, which I think is a viable thing to learn in school, right? And Apple has expertise there. So welcome, Apple, to the education. You're teaching about something you know. But beyond that, I feel like when I was a kid, there was much more skepticism about whether having kids make a multimedia presentation about gravity, like, and that they have this cute video of kids, you know, doing this project and making slow-mo videos on all their iOS devices and cutting it together and making animations and doing all that. Looks fun, seems expensive, and especially like these, you know, incredibly high production values for the things they do in these little promotional videos. But does that actually improve education? Like, there's enrichment and there is getting kids engaged with technology and there is having the advantage to do something a little bit different every once in a while. But I think the vision presented by Apple of that, like, all kids are doing creative multimedia digital things all the time is not representative of, like, the broader effort to educate. Like, those are the most fun parts, and you can make learning fun with the addition of technology, but you can make learning fun with the addition of, you know, just sitting in a circle and talking to each other, and, you know, or just going on a field trip. Or, like, it just seems to me that Apple seems uninterested in what will actually make education better and more interested in how can we make education better with our products? And I'm not entirely sure their products make education better in a way that is worth the money spent on. I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, schools shouldn't have computers or anything like that. It just seems to me that, like, that learning is not linked to the technology involved, right? That you can learn all the same things in exciting, engaging ways without having computers involved at all. Unless, of course, you're learning about computers, which, again, that's the angle that Apple has expertise on, and they're wise to lean on it, like learning to code and the Swift Playgrounds and all that stuff. But if you're not learning about computers, computers may help you. Typewriters may help you. Slates may help you. Pencils and lined paper may help you. But in the end, the learning part, it seems much more, there are so many other much bigger factors, starting with just like temperature control and safety, all the way up to class size and teachers that are not, you know, stressed out and are not underpaid and overworked, and, you know, just like, you know, curriculum that suits the students, different learning strategies, special help for the kids who need it. Like, there's so many more things that are more important to me than whether my kids have the latest iPad or Android devices or whatever, you know. So and I'm not saying that it's Apple's job to solve education's problem. It's just that I didn't even see a faint in that direction, a nod or an understanding to the fact that the most important thing in the classroom has nothing to do with the technology that's there, because they're there to sell you the technology. And that's what I found. That and my work concern about the fact that their strategy doesn't seem to be changing made me think that Apple is on the wrong track with its education strategy, and that if they continue to pursue it, they're not going to turn around their market share slide. And also, like, again, having two kids in school, it didn't make me think, boy, I wish my kids had access to iPads and Apple laptops. It just didn't, you know, like, I don't have any desire for that at all for my kids. I want my kids to, you know, learn and enjoy school and learn the things that they're supposed to learn, the social skills, like, to have a good school experience. I have no desires whatsoever about the technology they're using. I don't care if they use any technology unless they're interested in technology or unless they're taking a course in technology. And even then, I don't care if they teach the kids Pascal, teach them C++, teach them Scheme. Like, I don't care if they're learning Swift or iOS programming or anything like that. So I don't know. Maybe I'm overly grumpy about this.
No, I mean, I think you bring up a lot of really good points because, you know, I think maybe one of the reasons this event kind of rubbed me the wrong way is similar to what you were just saying about how, like, it seems like Apple more just wants to, like, yell at us about why they don't have to change much of anything, why their existing stuff can just be shoved right in there and be a perfect fit. And I think that over time, the compellingness or the fit of what they're trying to put into this category versus what these customers actually need and want is diverging. It's not getting closer over time. It's getting worse over time. Like the way I see it from both, you know, reading and listening to school workers who are like also writers in tech or podcasters, also from friends and family I know who work in education, some of them teachers, some of them administrators, it seems like what schools ultimately want is inexpensive, durable laptops and enterprise-style management tools and services to back them to make it easier to manage. Apple seems to me like they're losing this on three pretty major fronts. Price is obviously a big one. Like, you know, they are losing on price, not by as much as some people think. If you like look at, you know, iPads as being the solution, if you look at laptops as being the solution, though, they lose big. They also seem to be losing with, you know, just kind of, this is kind of the wrong product, I think. Like, and we have this argument a lot in you know, our regular, you know, tech beat of, is the iPad a good enough computer for various people for various things? And ultimately, I think while you could make some really nice marketing videos about how cool it would be if kids used iPads and to, you know, rediscover things like, you know, music and robots and stuff, that's not what most kids need most of the time in most classes. What they mostly need is laptops. And you can, and so what Apple is trying to sell the schools on is, no, look, yes, our laptops are way too expensive for what you're looking for. So instead, although they still sell a lot of them anyway, but instead, you should be looking at the iPad. That's why we don't need to make our laptops any cheaper, because the future is the iPad. And you can just bolt on all of these clunky, expensive accessories that raise the price even further, because you're not going to use that iPad at $329 or $299. You're going to have to add a case of some kind to protect it, because it's way too fragile to just give to kids naked. You can't even give to adults naked. So you got to get some kind of case. It's probably going to want some kind of keyboard for a lot of things it needs, or for standardized test requirements or things like that. So that's why they have this Logitech case that has this, you know, special keyboard and everything. And so you're adding, you have to add on all these accessories. Now they want you to buy a pencil or the Logitech crayon, which is interesting. They have to, you know, they want you to add on even more stuff to it to make it into what you want. All that drives up the price and the complexity and the clunkiness of the solution. So it's very possible, and I think likely, that they're actually selling schools the wrong product. What schools actually want is inexpensive, durable laptops. And then the third problem, which I don't see them probably ever fixing, is that, you know, if you talk to an administrator or a teacher who runs the Google G Suite stuff, or to an IT manager who runs the fleets of these things, the G Suite management tools are really good. Like that, it is an entire like enterprise management platform, and all these web services with Google Docs and all this stuff, that's really good. And Apple, I don't think, is ever going to do well in that kind of environment. They that's not in their DNA to make enterprise fleet management things very, very well, or to make cloud document platforms very well. They try, but not very hard, and it's never very competitive. And when you compare, I laughed so hard. They made a quick little remark about how when the iPad, how it supports multiple users only in a school environment, and the presenter said, "You can change users in under a minute."
Wow.
I was like, wow. Imagine no if it way. Took a minute to switch users on a PC or a Mac.
It wasn't even change users. It was you could log out and be ready for someone else to log in. Like they were touting the logout time. I think the login time could potentially be worse, because it does what it does under the covers is not like it's not like they're using the multi-user features of the underlying operating system. It's just like a single user iPad that they swap in and out by shuffling stuff around. It's not like multiple accounts in the Mac.
They're like tearing down the entire user space, tearing down all of Spring Board, swapping in various like directories and files, and then bringing the whole thing back up. It's basically, it's even more complex than a reboot, like what they're doing. And so, because these devices are not made for this at all. Like that, like it, you know, if you want that kind of thing, you need, you know, networked PCs and Macs. Like iPads are so not made for multi-user, and they're not willing to change iOS in major ways to fix that. They're only willing to do like, you know, this kind of like minor lip service stuff. So, you know, if you look at like Apple education, their history, they were always kind of like the fancy expensive ones that you'd have a few of in the schools. I was in school long before any kind of one-to-one program, so maybe that's different now, but. You know, Apple did well when it was Macs only, when they weren't trying to split their consumer computing ideal into these two very different platforms of Mac and iPad. So when there's just one platform for them to focus on, and in a world where that platform could basically be an island. It was like, here is a really nice desktop that you can use to edit videos and do desktop publishing on. They were really good at that. But today, you have large fleets of these, you know, always networked, strongly web services-based application platforms and enterprise management tools. And Apple just doesn't do that nearly as well or nearly as competitively as Google and Microsoft and other PC vendors that have, you know, tools for schools and stuff. I don't see that really ever changing. Apple is not that good at web services. They're not that good at enterprise management tools. They're in all the other areas of their business, they're actually pulling away from that. I also even question, like, if you're, you know, back in the olden days, there was always that thing, like, you know, no one gets fired for buying IBM. If you're an IT administrator at a school, and you are tasked with making this kind of decision of like, do you invest heavily in the Apple platform or in G Suite? Would you trust, knowing today's Apple, knowing how they do services, how they maintain applications over time, would you trust building your school out on like ClassKit and the classroom or schoolwork, whatever it's called, like all that stuff? Would you trust that to actually be not only bug-free when it ships not today, when it ships sometime in the future, would you trust that to be stable enough? And more importantly, would you trust that to be maintained and supported over a reasonable amount of time? I think that's a huge risk for an IT administrator to take. I think that's way too high of a risk, knowing the way Apple does things these days and knowing how seemingly stable and already well-developed and well-established the competing platforms are in these regards. I don't see this being a really good decision for an IT administrator pretty much anywhere.
That gets me back to my earlier point. Like this is enterprise software for schools. Like an enterprise software, in my old definition, is like software where the person you have to sell it to is not the person who has to use it. And there's two angles now. The one we already talked about, which is like management of large devices. In a world where you can actually conceive of one-to-one programs where every student gets one device, like that was not even in a twinkle in anyone's eye when I was in school. It was like you had a computer lab with like six computers in it for the whole school.
Yeah,
right? and they're all Apple IIs, by the way, not Macs. That enterprise management thing, like some of the people who watch this event I could see on Twitter were from that camp, like saying, okay, Apple, I have a problem. My problem is I have lots of students, I have lots of devices, and dealing with them is difficult. You got to keep track of them all. You got to keep them all up to date. You got to manage them all. Tell me, Apple, how you're going to make my job as an enterprise school administrator easy. That is enterprise software in both the good and bad senses. And I tend to look at the bad sense, because the bad sense is, say, Apple or Google or anybody makes these school administrators' lives easier and gives them an easy way to manage large fleets of devices. I, as a parent or as a general citizen interested in the education of the country, thinks, okay, but does every student having devices make their education better? Like, I don't care how easy it is for you, school administrator, to manage the devices. Like, I understand that's how they sell it to you. I understand that's why you're choosing, because you want something that can do all the things. You want it to hook into your back-end system that keeps track of all your students. You want to be able to, you know, but I'm not that interested in how easy it is for you to do your job. The whole point of the school is education. Is it better for the kids for everyone to have these devices? Does the device that the kids get, is there a difference to them, or is there no difference? Like, do the kids care if they have a Chromebook or the Apple stuff? Does it make a difference to their education? That's my question. And the second thing is that I worry about is, like, the other constituency that is not the students that Apple appeals to, just in general, but in education, is regardless of how hard it is to manage the devices, right? I feel like there is still, and, you know, maybe this has actually increased in the recent decade, some cachet for a school to say all our kids have iPads or have MacBook Airs, going back a little bit in time, or, you know, have Apple devices that if someone was touring the schools to think of buying a house in the neighborhood, and this is the neighborhood school your kid would go to, or if it's a private school or whatever, and you have Apple hardware everywhere, that makes the school seem better, because Apple, thanks to its marketing and the general high quality of its products in the consumer realm, is seen as a premium brand and as it's fancy, right? And so the parents go, ooh, all the kids here have iPads. Again, do the parents actually think, if they sat down and think about, well, are iPads going to make my child's school experience better than having one more teacher and making the class sizes smaller? Are iPads going to make my kid's educational experience better than if they had Chromebooks? They're not even thinking of that. They're just thinking, all the kids in this school, every school has an iBook. Like, that's why people were making that stampede for the $50 iBooks, because Apple, you know, makes fancy, nice devices that most people usually can't afford. And if you can suddenly get them for $50, it's like there's a rush on that, because there is a perceived value, a perceived coolness, cachet, marketing value, whatever, like status for Apple devices. So if you can get them cheap, all of a sudden people want to get them because they want a piece of that. And that bothers me in education too, because I don't want to pick schools based on how fancy the hardware is. It's like picking schools based on, like, you know, mahogany railings on the stairs. I mean, there is something to be said for schools that look fancy and feel nice and everything, but as far as education goes, like, do the kids care that the railings are mahogany? Like, beyond a minimum level of school upkeep and temperature control and safety and, you know, not, you know, pumping carbon monoxide into the building because the furnace is old, like, obviously they can get bad. But once you get into sort of the competent realm, I'm much less interested in that stuff than I am about all the other much more important aspects of the school. And even if Apple was massive, you know, take Google. Google seems to be very successful at appealing to people who are enterprise administrators, but I continue to wonder, in a school where the enterprise administrators, kind of like in a workplace where the enterprise administrators, their job is awesome and they love their vendor, do their end users love the product? Do the teachers love the product? Do the students love the product? Does it actually make their education better? I don't know. I have a real crisis of faith about technology and education, I guess.
So it feels to me, having not actually watched this particular event, but based on all of the recaps that I've read, it feels to me like this was, and I forget which one of you said it, I think it was Marco, this was a pep rally for Apple, but it was Apple trying to say, hey, you should consider us despite us. In other words, you know, there's so many things that we don't do the way you want us to do it, but you know what? There's some other stuff that's really cool. And I guess there's a couple of ways to look at that, right? Like, you could look at that as Apple is obnoxious and full of themselves. And, oh, of course, we're so fancy. And look at us and our fancy iPads and our AR and blah, blah, blah. But I don't really take it that way at all. I took it as, hey, look, we genuinely aspire to make a engaging, interesting, enlightening, and diverse in terms of experienced educational, like, not event, but, you know, we want education to be interesting, basically. And here's a way that we are, or several ways that we are enabling that in making education interesting and making the education part relatively frictionless. Now, the penalty is that the poor school administrator is going to pay for that tenfold. But for the teacher and the student, if you buy what Apple's selling, literally and figuratively, then it's reasonably frictionless, right? So you should consider this, because we are like the aspirational version of education that all of us really want, aren't we? you should really look at us, despite the fact that we're way too expensive and way too difficult to work with. And that's how I took the event, again, not having seen it. I took it as, look, we're here, you know, knock, 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 we're here, and we do cool stuff, and if you really want to get your kids engaged, maybe try us, because no kid today wants a laptop anymore. I mean, maybe that's what they need. I mean, I know you said that earlier, Marco, although I challenge, I'm not entirely sure why. I mean, my gut says, yeah, they, of course they need laptops, but then I ask myself, well, why? And other than a keyboard, I don't have a good answer. And I'm not here to have that argument at this particular moment. It doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things, but
everyone says iPads are like, everyone's going to be doing tablets in the future. And because my kid loves tablets and doesn't know what a laptop is. And it's like, okay, wait till your kid is a little bit older. And then, like, you know, how many kids get to the end of high school without having or wanting a laptop?
Yeah, yeah. And I agree with you. But all I'm saying is there's the obnoxious Apple hubris way of looking at this, which is we are so much better than everyone else because look at how cool we are. And then there's the more humble, hey, man, we're cool too, right? Like, check us out. We're worth at least considering. And that's how I took the event. But in the end of the day, it all comes, well, not all, but generally speaking, and this is what Saplinski and I were kind of going back and forth about, in general, it all comes down to money, and it's just too damn expensive.
We are sponsored this week by Aftershocks Bone Conduction Headphones. Visit atp.aftershocks.com to learn more. Bone conduction delivers music through your cheekbones, ensuring your ears remain completely open to hear the sounds around you. The Aftershocks new Trex Air weighs just 1 ounce that has a full titanium wraparound band. You barely even notice that it's on. The open ear design eliminates ear fatigue caused by earbuds that are shoved in your ears. And they're IP55 certified to repel sweat, dust, and moisture. Whether you're working out or just walking in the rain, you are totally fine. The Aftershocks Trex Titanium and the Trex Air are, I just love these things. I've had them both now. I had the Trex Titanium for months, and then I upgraded to the Trex Air when that came out. These are wonderful little headphones because they can fit in a pocket, and they're not earbuds, so they're way more comfortable on me. And because of their design, where they leave your ears open, you hear everything around you. So I love wearing them when I'm walking outside because that way I can hear things like cars or even just if people walk by and they say hello, I can hear that and I can respond like a human being instead of being my weird little isolated, you know, walking person with headphones. It's really, really nice. Go to atp.aftershocks.com to learn more, and you can use code ATP30 to get $30 off the Trex Air. Once again, atp.aftershocks.com, and use code ATP30 to get $30 off the wonderful Trex Air bone conduction headphones. I love these things. You will too. Thank you so much to Aftershocks for sponsoring our show.
Now, we haven't really talked about the actual product announcement that happened during this event. So
product.
We should, the product, which, I mean, to be fair, I don't think anyone should have really expected more than this. I think we were all, myself included, aspirationally hoping for more than just a new iPad. But realistically, this is what the tea leaves were showing. So,
yeah.
Marco, tell us about this new iPad.
So it is updated guts for the actually, you know, interesting one that they released last year without an event at all. So it was the last spring, about a year ago, they released the inexpensive 9.7-inch iPad for $329, built with old parts, basically, to make it cheaper. And you know, it's kind of like the way the iPhone SE is kind of like built with old parts on the iPhone end to make that cheaper. It's basically the iPad SE. They basically kind of remade the iPad Air 1 with modern guts, so it doesn't have some of the niceties. And then, so the news now is that they have now updated that model. And by the way, I think that model is almost single-handedly responsible for the turnaround in iPad sales. I think the numbers show from the analysts and stuff that iPad sales went up starting with this model because it turns out when you drop the price of the entry-level model to a lineup, a lot more people want to buy it. So they can learn a lot from the laptop line. Anyway,
and to whoever's point it was before, kids do love iPads, like from very young kids all the way up. So there was always an appetite, a desire for iPads, but you're not going to buy a $600 iPad for a toddler. So a $300 one starts to get into the realm of possibility.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, so they introduced this you know, lower price point for the entry level iPad last year, and it sold very well. And then now they've updated it with newer components. It is now roughly the guts of an iPhone 7. In most important ways, it just in like an iPad size case with an iPad size screen. It is not the nicest screen. It's basically like an iPad Air 1 kind of screen. So it doesn't have the close lamination of the screen to the glass. So you could, there's like a small visible gap. Although, I mean, it's not that big.
Oh, on that topic, I would love to know if someone knows if that increases repairability, because that's all I could think of. It's like, why don't they use the laminated screen? Maybe it's because if students drop it, they can replace the top glass without replacing the screen, or maybe I'm wrong about that. So someone at the Genius Bar, let us know.
That's an interesting thought. I mean, I figured it was just for cost, you know, and for segmentation, because, see, I think one of the issues I have with this, so anyway, if you go down the specs, there's not a lot of differences between this and the 10.5-inch iPad Pro. There are some, and they might be big for you, but it's actually not hugely different, and it's half the price of the iPad Pro. So, you know, there are some differences, and again, they may matter to you. As our friend Federico Fatici pointed out, the new cheap iPad does not have the ProMotion 120 hertz refresh rate, does not have the P3 wide color, True Tone, a smart connector for the keyboard, and then the camera is not as good. It does not have image stabilization, does not shoot 4K video, and it only has first generation Touch ID. It does now support the Apple Pencil, which is interesting. I don't know how much that's going to matter in practice, because at least not for schools. I can't imagine.
Apple were pushing that so hard, by the way, like the pencil support. Every one of the slot, the whole visual theme of the show was things drawn with the Apple Pencil. Every slide, every, like, it was very consistent. Beautiful drawings, as always, with Apple. Beautiful presentation. They were leaning heavily on the pencil. But the pencil, of course, is $100 extra. That's why people are talking about the iPads. You have the iPad, then you got $50 to $100 for a case, $100 for the pencil, and the crayon was half the price, but it doesn't do tilt. It just doesn't do pressure. It just does tilt and touch.
The Logitech crayon is interesting. It's like, if they would sell that separately, and if it would work with regular iPads, it doesn't, though. It only works with this one. It doesn't work with the iPad Pros, and it is only sold through the education channel. So, like, you can't just go on Apple.com and order one, which is unfortunate, because it's Logitech's device that is really an Apple Pencil inside. It has the same benefits as the Apple Pencil, except for it does not have pressure sensitivity. But I know a lot of people who would buy that, and it's like a little bit more ergonomic. It has a button. Like, it's actually kind of better in some ways. I mean, and, you know, it doesn't look as nice and everything, but honestly, I would probably have bought one of those if it worked on the iPad Pro.
But people can't use it for art without the pressure sensitivity, though. Like, I continue to think that the Apple Pencil, I mean, the Apple Pencil is great and all, but I think it's just too expensive. Like, maybe for the Pro models, it's like, who cares? But it just, I really wish there was a pencil for less than $100.
Yeah, and it really does have a few pretty annoying design flaws. I know, like Mike made the case on Connected this past week, that we all made fun of it, how, like, you know, you can charge it by sticking it up the butt of the iPad, and it looks really funny. But he made the case that that's, you know, actually a good thing in practice, and that's fine. I think the Apple Pencil has lots of design problems. It you know, it has the issue of, it's, you know, there's nothing to grip on it. It is a little bit too big and a little bit too heavy. The battery life is not good enough, and because there is no power switch, the battery is constantly draining itself if you're, like, carrying it in a bag and it's in motion, or using the iPad without using the pencil. And of course, there's nowhere to put it on the iPad or around the iPad. So there's lots of problems that the pencil has. The Logitech crayon solves some of those, and it's kind of a shame that you have to rely on that, Apple doesn't, like, stoop down to the level of making something ergonomic with a button on it, even though that would actually make it a better product in some ways. But anyway, going back to this iPad's a really good deal. Like, you're getting a lot for this. And if anything, I think it really highlights how incredibly expensive the iPad Pro is for what you're getting there. Like, to get a decently equipped one of these, which we'll get to in a little while, you know, you're looking at, you know, $400, you know, once you throw in some accessories, maybe more. With the iPad Pro, you're looking at about $800, and it's really, you're getting, for double the price, you're getting a nicer and slightly larger screen, the smart connector, which gives you the opportunity to spend another $200 on the keyboard, And a little bit better camera, which a lot of people don't use or don't care about on the iPad. So it's like the difference that you're getting is, and it's not, I don't think it's a twice the price difference to go from this to the iPad Pro. And again, this is only going to be for a few months because presumably in June, they're probably going to update the iPad Pro to make it even better. But I do think this kind of illustrates quite how expensive the iPad Pro is compared to how expensive it needs to be, because this shows what they can do at $329.
This iPad feels a little bit chintzy to me, though. Like, I understand it's got to be a cut-down model. Like, it makes sense to have it in the product line. I think they should have a cheap iPad, setting aside education, just for regular people, right? But some of the cheaping out, like, I've complained about this before. I really wish Apple would make less expensive products that were not merely old parts or old, like a purpose-built product to hit a much lower price point. Like in this case, the one that really burns me is Touch ID. Doesn't have second gen Touch ID, because that just feels like it's like, come on. Like, I understand. I don't need P3 color gamut. I don't need ProMotion. Like True Tone, maybe Smart Connector. Okay. Maybe that's like a feature that schools don't want or whatever. Camera, sure, by all means, cheap out. But the Touch ID, you unlock it. Like, it's like everything, like we can't have any nice things. It's like, as if Apple was selling cheaper, imagine Apple sold lots of Macs. If they were selling cheaper Macs with USB 2 in them still, right? And it'd be like, come on, at a certain point, USB 2, isn't it more expensive for you than USB 3? Like, just, I know it's not quite the same thing, but
the USB-C cable that comes with all the MacBook Pros is a USB 2 cable.
Yeah, I just feel like you have to make the product not feel like you're getting second class in everything. I feel like, and this is a thing that Steve Jobs used to do, and my impression from the outside is that basically through sheer force of will, because it's what he wanted, is periodically they would update the whole line and they would expunge some lesser thing from the entire line top to bottom. Even the cheapest one wouldn't have the thing that Steve Jobs no longer likes. He loved to refresh the whole line and say, it's all gone. And in the Tim Cook era, refreshing the whole line pretty much never happens. Like, you get new things at the top, but the middle and bottom is just like, it's like hand-me-downs and secondhand stuff and just hanging out down there with yesterday's technology. You never get the clean sweep to go through. It says, we have a whole new line of products from super low price to super high price, and all of them, we talked about this before, look like a family and are brought up to some minimum standard, right? So that, like, second-gen Touch ID should be everywhere by now. You should not have first-gen Touch ID. It should be a relic of the past, but it's like, can we save an extra $1.50? Yes, we can. Keep shipping the old one. No, don't keep shipping the old one. Like, even the lowest-end Apple product, I feel like, has to be brought along with all the other tech at some minimum level. I don't know. The product annoys me a little bit. I do agree that it's great that it's there. It's much better than not having it at all. But I don't like it.
Tim Cook has no minimum standard. That's like, if you look at, you said, like, raising everything to a minimum standard, like, he has no minimum. He will sell the oldest, lowest end parts forever as long as there's still money to be made there. That's why, like, I think if Apple was truly a premium company, if they really wanted that quality, and honestly, I don't say this often, if Steve was still there, I do not think they would be selling anything today with a spinning disc or a non-retina screen.
Yeah, it's because, like, as a product guy, as Steve so much was, it's like, and I attribute to him because he was had the last say in so many things. It's like, once you have the new thing, you don't want anyone to have the old thing anymore. Like, you want, like, obviously price is a factor and you can't just make everyone retina overnight. But, like, once you see a retina screen, God, can you look at a non-retina screen anymore? And, as soon as that's feasible price-wise, you want to put that in everything. Same thing with second-gen Touch ID. First-gen Touch ID, yeah, it's our first cut at it. But once we get the second-gen one and the price comes down, like, once it gets close enough, it's time to refresh the whole line and forget about first-gen Touch ID. You're never going to see that in an Apple product again. Everything is second-gen. Just because it was like you feel like you want everyone to have your new thing. And, yeah, Tim does not seem to have that instinct. He feels no kind of
shame.
I'm gonna say embarrassment, or it's not shame or embarrassment. That's too much. It's more like, just when you make a new thing, you want everyone to see your best. You want everyone to see the best thing that you have to offer. And again, obviously, price comes into it. Everyone can't get a P3 screen. Everyone can't get ProMotion, right? But there's a trickle down effect. And a product person would be like, boy, I can't wait until it's financially feasible for me to offer P3 P3 displays on all our products. When is that going to happen? Give me a timeline. 5 years from now or whatever. Let's go for that, because that will be a milestone. Like, that we will have raised the bar on all of our products. And Tim Cook is like, I don't care if that ever happens. Keep shipping the TN display on the MacBook Air with giant pixels and terrible color reproduction as long as people buy it. And that's not, I don't like that.
This is a good time to bring up another point that we had in the notes here, which is that Apple's still selling the iPad Mini 4 for $70 more than this new iPad. It has an A8.
As opposed to an A10.
And yep, still selling it. No end in sight, and also no replacement in sight for that product, even though I think people would buy it. But
it's got an A8, no Apple Pencil support, and a smaller display, and it's $70 more. This is another an article from The Verge, by the way. And this is another example of Apple's product lines not being coherent. Lay out all the iPads before me and explain to me what the progression is through your line or what the use cases are. And then you get to the iPad Mini 4, you'd be like, this is like for people who want something smaller but want it to be two generations behind our least expensive one and have no pencil support. And I don't know. Like, I mean, maybe they're in an in-between period, but we used to say that in the beginning, like, oh, this line is in a transition, right? But now I feel like we have enough time to say all the lines are constantly in transition. They never get to their destination. They never get to the point where there is a line that makes sense and that has good products at all price points. It's always just this long tail of the residue of yesteryear falling off the product line, or not falling off, as the case may be.
We are sponsored this week by Away. For $20 off your suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/ATP and use promo code ATP during checkout. Away makes high-quality suitcases with very smart design features at a much lower price compared to most other brands. They cut out the middlemen and the whole retail chain, and they sell directly to you without all that markup that all those middlemen have to add. Away suitcases come from over 10 different colors and over 5 sizes. They have carry-ons, bigger carry-ons, medium, large, even a kid's carry-on. All of their suitcases are made with premium German polycarbonate that's very lightweight, and it bends when it gets impacted, so it doesn't break. The interior features a patent-pending compression system. I love compression suitcases. They really, really help when you have to get a little bit more in there. They have 4 spinner wheels, and this is really nice. If you've never used a 4-wheel suitcase, the way it handles is so nice, especially for the larger ones. I very much like those. There's a TSA-approved combination lock. They also have a removable, washable laundry bag, so you can keep your dirty clothes separate from your clean ones as you travel, and then when you get home, you just pop it out and dump it in the laundry. It's wonderful. And the carry-ons, you might have heard about this, the carry-ons have built-in batteries, and they can charge any USB devices, so you can be charging your phone while you're sitting at the gate waiting for the plane, and that way the whole flight, you got a full phone. It's wonderful. They also have new add-ons now. They have packing cubes, which I've recently gotten into. And packing cubes, if you don't know, they're surprisingly useful. They're really good. Give them a shot. Away also offers garment sleeves and all sorts of wonderful other accessories for traveling. All this is protected by a lifetime warranty. If anything breaks, they will fix or replace it for you for life. And they have a 100-day trial. You can try their suitcases. You can even travel with them, of course. How else would you try them? You can travel with them for 100 days. If you don't like it, you can return it for a full refund, no questions asked. And all of this comes with free shipping on any Away order within the continental U.S. So check out today, awaytravel.com/ATP, and use promo code ATP during checkout for $20 off your suitcase. Once again, for $20 off, awaytravel.com/ATP, promo code ATP. Thank you so much to Away for sponsoring our show.
All right, let's move on and do some Ask ATP, shall we? Let's start with Chris Ovrebo, who asks, which Apple product, when purchased from Apple, including refurbished and clearance, provides the most value or functionality per dollar? In other words, what's the biggest bang for your buck? I don't have a good answer for this.
I do.
Okay, good. Well, we
don't
will
worry.
Get to you.
Go ahead.
We will get to you momentarily. My first, which is not good, is whatever the best iPhone is you can buy. Because given all of the things that you can do with your phone and how amazing your phone will be, get the best one you can. It'll be great bang for your buck. My second answer, which is probably the better of the two, is AirPods. They are expensive, but they provide, if assuming they fit in your ears, they provide me endless amounts of joy. I cannot speak highly enough of the AirPods. So let's go to Mark. Let's go to John, who will hopefully have a very quick answer. And then Marco, you can take us home.
AirPods is a good one, but I still feel like 160 is too much. My answer is the iPhone 8. I think the most expensive iPhone is too much. Like the iPhone 10, it's not worth the price premium, but the iPhone 8 is a fantastic phone. Like it is, it's, you know, if the iPhone 10 didn't exist, the iPhone 8 would be a worthy top end phone. And because the iPhone 10 does exist, it can be less expensive. And yeah, the iPhone 8 is still expensive, but it's a really great phone. And I feel like it gets overlooked, and the iPhone is Apple's best product. They put their best stuff into it. It has the highest success rate. So I feel like that's the most bang for the buck. Even though it is a hell of a lot of bucks, it's also a hell of a lot of bang.
That's a really good pick. I will give you that. All right. So I kind of have multiple picks. It depends on like what category you're looking at. I thought about, you know, stuff like AirPods, but I wanted to just focus on like computers, phones, and iPads. So like you know, so I'm not going to say like, well, you know, this one lightning cable is the best bang for the buck in the whole store.
You know. None of Apple's cables are the best bang for your buck.
I know. That's actually also true. I thought about that and looked. I'm like, no, I can't. There's nothing in these categories anyway. And I wanted to enforce some minimum standards of making things usable. And so iOS devices, I decided needed to have at least 64 gigs of storage. And for anything I picked that was an iPad, it had to include a smart cover. So that adds $40 to the iPad prices. For the Mac, I thought at least a 256 gig SSD or a 1 terabyte Fusion drive. And if it's a USB-C model that I was considering, I added a $100 allowance for adapters and hubs. Because I truly, and I don't mean to go off on the laptops again. I truly don't believe that the modern USB-C only laptops are useful without having, you know, $50 to $100 worth of adapters and hubs for them. In the same way that an iPad is not useful without some kind of cover or case. Anyway, so in the iPhone category, which I think is my overall category probably, because iPhones are just so damn useful and so damn good, I actually picked the iPhone 7 128 Jet Black. This goes for $650 new or $590 currently refurbished from Apple.com. You know, I looked at the iPhone SE 128. That's $450. That's only new. There's no refurbs for that. So $450 for the iPhone SE or $590 for an iPhone 7 refurb. That is such a good phone. I like it better than the 8 because the great advantage of the Jet Black is you don't really need a case because there's so much grip on it. And I think it looks better, honestly, than the 8 does. And it's still a really solid modern internal phone. That's literally the CPU they just put in this new iPad we were just talking about. So the iPhone 7 128 Jet Black, new or refurb, I think is the best buy right now in the iPhone lineup and possibly the entire Apple lineup. I will also say in the iPad lineup, that new iPad, the new 9.7 iPad, 128 gigs with smart cover is $470. That's a really good deal. You can also get last year's version of it with smart cover refurbished for $350. That's an excellent deal. And you can get the cellular version of last year's model of that 9.7 in 128 for $450 refurbished. That's a cellular iPad. I really enjoy a cellular iPad because if you're talking about like how can I make this thing the most useful to me? Adding cellular really helps a lot. This is one of the reasons why I wish they'd add it to the laptops, because it really makes this like a truly like portable work device. It's just like a giant phone then, and it's really very nice to have that sometimes. In the laptop category, if you are limiting yourself to the only modern, you know, 2016 forward MacBooks, the 13-inch MacBook Escape with 256 gig SSD is $1,600 new. Or $1,370 refurb. Both of those include that $100 allowance for dongles and hubs. If you don't need Retina, the 13-inch MacBook Air is still sold. $256 gives you $1,200 new or $980 refurb.
I can't pay $900 for anything with that screen on it.
I know, that's why I had this as like a huge caveat. If you don't need or care about Retina, that's a really great buy.
It's not the Retina. It's the viewing angles and color reproduction. I just think it's a bad screen.
Well, I think if you don't care about Retina, you're probably not going to care about that either. Oh, and for desktop, you know, 4K iMac, I think. 8 1 terabyte Fusion. 4K iMac is $1,400 new, $1,270 refurb. That's the way to go on that. However, I think the best Mac value is, to nobody's surprise, the 2015 15-inch MacBook Pro base model.
Oh, here we go.
It's $2,000 new or it's $1,700 refurb. For $1,700 refurb, you get a hell of a computer. You get 16 gigs of RAM, which none of the other ones offer at these prices, 256, of course, quad core processor. And then you have all the ports you need. You have a keyboard and trackpad that are non-controversial and reliable. You don't need any dongles or anything. That is still, I think, the best overall value in the Mac lineup. So overall, iPhone 7 Jet Black and the 2015 15-inch base model.
I've got that iPhone, and I think the 8 is a better deal. Maybe it's because I just checked my battery health, and it's at 87%, and I felt worse about my phone.
Womp, womp. All right, cool. Anson Jablinski writes, hey, what did Marco play in marching band, or what musical experience does each of the hosts have, if any? So, Marco, what did you play in marching band?
I was in the percussion section, so I started out as a freshman on crash cymbals, right at the bottom of the totem pole there, and then sophomore year I was on snare drum. Junior and senior year, I was on quads.
Fair enough. I have never played anything with any sort of efficacy whatsoever, except I play a mean stereo. Never mind. John?
I played keyboards as a kid. We had like electric keyboards in the house. I noodled around on those. I did actually take piano lessons for some short period of time, but I could play songs that I wanted to play, like from the radio and stuff on keyboards. And in college, I picked up a guitar because everybody on my floor in my dorm, my freshman dorm, had guitars. And so it was impossible not to pick up a guitar. All of those instruments I'm pretty much terrible at. And I could never sight read music, but I could kind of non-sight read it briefly for certain instruments.
Moving on. The Italian Stallion, who is apparently not John Syracuse, asks, backpack recommendations that would fit a 15-inch MacBook Pro? I know you just said backpack, but if you don't have to have a backpack, then I really love my Tombin Cadet, which I'll put a link in the show notes to my review of that. I have also heard but have not tried myself that the Tombin Synapse is excellent, and that is a backpack, but that's probably not useful. So does one of you have a backpack recommendation that you enjoy?
I have, so to me, backpacks are kind of like the way most people think of to-do apps and, like, you know, task managers. I'm always about 80% satisfied with the backpack I have, and I'm frequently trying new ones as a result. And so I have tried some really nice ones, actually. You know, some of these are wonderful. I have the Waterfield Designs Stod laptop backpack. They make a bunch of good stuff. And that's very good. Holds a 15-inch just fine. I have a really nice Briggs & Riley backpack. That was something like $200. And I forget exactly which model it is. One of like the Active series. That's pretty nice, too. I recently got a Peak Design Everyday backpack. And that's also really nice. Ultimately, all of these are very good. None of them are perfect. I have not yet tried Tombin. I believe the Synapse 25 would be the one to get. I was looking at that.
Yep.
I would love to see it sometime. I might end up trying it out anyway, but all of these have pluses and minuses, and it depends a lot on what you're doing. If you're using it for like every day carrying it to work, that's a very different type of needs from if you're using it like to bring it on planes and travel with it, or to also have like, you know, a weekend worth of clothing and stuff in it. Like, these are very different needs. The Waterfield one is beautiful, very stylish, trendy, looks nice. The Briggs & Riley one I found has a lot of pluses to it, but ultimately I didn't care for the layout of the interior space. Like, a lot of things are hard to reach, hard to access. There's a lot of seemingly wasted space with like weird padding areas and stuff that I don't think need to be there or should be arranged differently. The Peak Design Everyday backpack is my current one. I've got it recently, and it also is very nice with a few flaws. It really does not hold very much. I got the smaller one of the two, and I'm kind of thinking maybe the bigger one might have been the better bet. It's fine in that way, but it holds plenty. If you want it to be like a laptop bag going to work, I would say, though, for a 15-inch MacBook Pro, it just barely fits in the Peak Design. Like, the laptop pocket is very tight. It's squeezing my laptop such that I'm getting keyboard imprints on the screen, so I don't love that. I honestly would not recommend it for daily use, if only for that, whereas the Waterfield Stod, I think, is better for that. But at these prices, I expect like perfection to pay you know, $300-ish for a backpack, and I haven't found that yet. So I'm all ears if anybody has something else they like. But ultimately, I think that it's the kind of category where, like, what's perfect for one person is going to be totally wrong for another person, and it's all going to be personal preference. And you just got to, you know, try it out and see for yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
So the closest I've got to a backpack that I really like is actually, it's not sold anymore, but there's an equivalent. Is this L.L. Bean backpack. I don't know what the heck model mine is, but the closest one they have is now called the Quad Backpack, and it's so close. I like backpacks, first of all, that are cheap. This is like $80. They have tons of little pockets everywhere on them, so you can put all those dongles that we need in this dongle lifestyle that we have now. It's got an inside pocket that will fit any, you know, fit a 15-inch laptop and also an iPad inside a case inside that same pocket, and then it's got tons of other interior space and all sorts of little pockets, and it's kind of... It's not fashionable. It's not made of nice materials. It's just kind of like durable, kind of like camping type equipment, right? It's not, there's no leather anywhere on this thing, right? So if you want to look good, forget about it. The one thing that annoys me about this backpack that you should be warned about is that it has tons of weird straps everywhere. Like, oh, if you're stuffing it filled with camping stuff, you need the strap that goes around your waist and the straps, the two straps on the side that hold the backpack together. And I considered cutting them off, but it's actually kind of hard to cut them off because it's pretty durable. So, but I have found a way to tuck the straps that I'm not using into some of the pockets, so they're mostly out of the way. It's still an annoyance. If it didn't have those straps, I think it would be close to perfect for me, because that's what I want. I want it to be cheap, durable, light, and have tons of pockets and zippers and not fall apart. And so far, this L.L. Bean backpack has fit the bill.
I will say, too, in for the Peak Design Everyday Backpack, it really excels at hiding all of the extra straps and stuff that it can, that can be used in a pinch. Like, every strap that it has some kind of pocket that it belongs in when it's not being used, and so it's totally invisible and out of the way. It is very well designed for, like, expansion of that. But yeah, ultimately, like, I wish it was a little bigger, so I might have to try the bigger version of it. But and I also wish that laptop compartment wasn't so crushing, but hopefully this summer I'll move to a 13-inch newer one, and that should probably solve that problem for me. Do you packing cubes when you travel?
Nope. Not in the traditional sense. I do have that Go Pack that I talk about all the time that is sort of ish like a packing cube that's just basically got all my dongles and things of that nature in it. But what you're talking about, I think, is, you know, packing like clothes and other things of that nature in packing cubes. And this appeals to me from an organizational standpoint. I feel like this is something that I would really like, but I've never done it. And it doesn't seem like, I don't really get why people would do this, even though it sounds like it would be something I would like, you know what I mean? So what are you asking, because you haven't, or because you're trying it now, or what brings this up?
So I recently started. A lot of our friends travel a lot, way more than I do, and I kept hearing from people like, oh, you got to try packing cubes, or just generally like the style of traveling or packing where you have like sub bags in your bags, you know, because that's all packing cubes are just like, you know, rectangular solid sub bags that you put in your bags. That's basically it. And so, you know, I was usually of the style of using the bag's pockets as dividers and compartments. But the packing cube and sub bag lifestyle seems to want to have just like large open compartments in the bags. And then you have your own like sub bag things that you put in there that are separate from that. To be your separation and organization. And so I recently tried, I wanted to, when I got my cool Peak Design Everyday backpack, I decided to also try the packing cube lifestyle for a couple of these trips I've taken recently. And I got to say, I see the benefit. It's pretty cool. Like, Tiff made fun of me relentlessly, but then she wanted some as soon as she saw how they worked. Because what's nice about them is that there's a few benefits. Number one, like, it is actually nicer to organize things that way in a bag. And if you get the compression cubes, which have like slightly compressing zippers around the perimeter, it actually does help compress your clothes slightly in a controlled way that doesn't, like, you know, excessively wrinkle them or anything. But a really nice thing about the packing cubes is that when you arrive at a hotel, you can just take the packing cubes right out of your bag and just place them like in the drawers. If you use the drawers in a hotel, you just put them in the drawers and open them up, and then you have like, oh, here's my sock rectangle, you know, here's my shirt rectangle, and it's like, it's actually really nice. And so I think I've been converted. I want to do a little more traveling with them. I've done two trips so far with them, but I think I'm being converted to the sub bag and packing cube lifestyle.
Hmm. So what you said you have one for socks and like one for shirts, or what did you end up doing?
So so I got a variety of sizes. If you're looking at the Eagle Creek ones, I would say the small and medium sizes are the ones to get. The rest of the sizes I have not yet found much of a use for. So small, medium, and compression if possible. And they're not cheap. They end up being like $25 each, something like that. But they do seem pretty well made. I have like the tech line that has like slightly higher tech fabric and it's a little bit lighter. I haven't quite worked the whole system yet, but I have like, you know, one of them I'll basically put like all my underwear and socks in. And this depends on like how much you need to bring. And I've only, again, used this for two trips so far. So take all this with a grain of salt. But like all underwear and socks will go in one, and then all t-shirts will go in another. And then if I have like extra pants, I'll put those in one. And that's about it. They have some that you can fold like dress shirts into. I haven't tried that yet. It's kind of nice, and then it makes it easier to pack. It makes it more organized in the bag to get stuff, or if you have to move stuff around in the bag, if you have to rearrange stuff, it's surprisingly nice. Like I thought they were pointless, but now I get it, and I'm sold.
You know, I've tried a new thought technology with regard to packing, which is rolling rather than folding.
Oh, the rolling people.
Oh yeah, you roll the stuff into the packing cubes. That helps a lot.
I feel like it's probably a placebo, but I really feel like I can get considerably more stuff into my bag when it's rolled, and it's more likely to come out less wrinkled. It is still a wrinkled disaster, but it is less so than when I fold. And so I have been converted to the rolling lifestyle. That, like I said, that's a new thought technology in my world that I have embraced. But the packing cube is still beyond me. John, why do you scoff at rolling? You're not a fan?
I'm not. There's a couple of reasons. I'm not into rolling, and I'm not into the packing things. The rolling, it's both the same reason, I guess. And I feel like all of my items of clothing have a natural size that they want to be folded at. And that size is not rolled, and it probably doesn't match any of the packing things. Like I need to fold things at the size that they want to be folded. They speak to me. Like how big should I be? And if I try to fold my shirts bigger or smaller, maybe it's because I'm a limited folder. Maybe I have a limited repertoire of folding skills. Like I'm not good at folding laundry. I fold things the way I fold them, and I let the garment tell me how it wants to be folded. Right. And the other thing is with my let the garment speak to me and tell me how to folding combined with my fairly obsessive overpacking, I can pack any of my suitcases easily to the point where they exceed the weight limit that airlines have. So I don't need any compression thing to help me get more into the bag. If anything, I have to intentionally pack less efficiently so I don't go over the weight limit and have to pull things out of my bag to get it on the plane. Because the weight limits are like, what, 50 pounds, 40, 50 pounds?
Well, it's not a weight limit so much as there's a fee if you go over it.
Yeah, well, anyway, I don't want to have that fee, and I don't want to go over the limit. And sometimes it actually is a limit, and they'll make you check another bag or something. So I am always on the ragged edge of that limit with no packing cubes and no rolling and folding my clothes the way they naturally want to be folded. So I feel like this is not a problem I have in my life, and I'm not looking for ways to jam more stuff into my suitcase, and I'm definitely not looking for ways to make me have to learn how to fold my clothes in a different way than the one and only way I know how to fold them.
Well, it is really nice if you're checking a bag, then yeah, you're right. The weight limit is usually a bigger problem. But it's really nice if you are kind of on the border between needing to check it and being able to fit it in a carry-on. And I love just traveling with a carry-on if possible.
Oh,
it's so nice to just bypass the baggage claim and just walk right, just leave, and you're just done. You have everything you need with you. You can just walk out and you're done. Like that's wonderful. So where this stuff helps is not in cramming, you know, 75 pounds worth of stuff into a very large check bag, but in fitting into a carry-on where otherwise you might not have fit into a carry-on.
Or if you're underscore, not even having a carry-on, but just having a backpack for an entire week, which just still blows my mind because, like I said, I'm a massive overpacker, and he apparently needs no human sustenance of any kind. It can just...
it is very satisfying to be packed very lightly on a trip and to need very little and to use everything you have. Like I tried one of the trips I just took was this trip where I was helping my family member move, and because I was going to be like, you know, taking space in a very full moving convoy of trucks, I didn't want to have a large bag myself. I figured that was wasteful, and you know, I want to leave as much space as possible for his stuff.
You've got a whole moving truck. You're afraid you aren't going to have room? You have a moving truck.
Oh, you haven't seen this stuff. But it was full. And so I brought, for this trip, I brought only my Peak Design Everyday backpack. And I shoved everything I needed for 3 days, or 4 days, whatever it was, into this backpack. It was glorious. Like, there was no space left over, and I had to do some pretty crazy stuff, and I only had one pair of pants. But it was glorious to have everything fit in like one backpack, including my computer, these two walkie-talkies, some accessories for driving. Like, I brought like my cell phone, suction cup, piece of garbage. Like, I brought a whole bunch of, like, you know, stuff that would be necessary for the trip.
Coffee tubes.
Yeah, I brought my tubes of instant coffee, my tubes of Southern coffee, excuse me. And
so does now does all your items of clothing smell like coffee because they're all wedged into this bag with the coffee tubes?
No, the tubes are sealed.
All right, I don't know.
No,
you said they were canvas. I thought maybe they'd be
no. They're plastic tubes that come in a pretty canvas bag.
All right.
Yeah. So, and it is very satisfying. I would love, like, to travel to WWDC. I would love to travel with just like one of the smallest roller bag size, you know, like that, like the pilots usually have. I have one of those. It's glorious. I love being able to fit into that. The only reason I don't for WWDC is that we bring like a whole podcast studio. So I have all this gear, but like on trips where I don't have that, I love packing as small as possible.
Should I ask Underscore? Maybe he can fit the podcasting studio in one of his inside jacket pockets.
Probably.
No, I really want to just emphasize what you guys are saying about Underscore's packing, because we for a long time would fly out together. I would drive up to Dulles, which is reasonably close to his house, and we would take the same flight and try to sit next to each other and whatnot. And I would be rolling in with like my laptop bag, which is bursting at the seams, and in a carry-on bag, which was bursting at the seams. And that pain in my rear end rolls in with like a lightly stuffed backpack. It's not even, I shouldn't even say stuffed, like a lightly packed backpack. And that is all he has. That's his computer. That's his toiletries, his luggage. Everything is
for
in this backpack
for a week.
It's inhuman. I've asked him about this every year. I ask him about this, and every year he just kind of shrugs and smirks and basically says, "Yeah, I don't need a lot." It's both delightful and infuriating all at the same time, because I'm like John. I pack way too much, and over the years I have gotten that beaten out of me. Like, over time, I have gotten better about not packing everything in the world. And I still pack way too much. So.
And what you just described is half of what I pack, because you were like, you have a laptop bag and a roller bag. I have a full size suitcase, like the biggest, the highest weight limit suitcase you can get. And then my backpack.
I mean, I adore my Away suitcase, and they happen to be sponsoring this episode. And the carry-on, I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful suitcase. I would say that even if we weren't compensated to say that, but it is not, you know, cavernous. It's carry-on. I mean, which makes sense. And I can get, you know, like, well, last year I got my entire week's worth of luggage, my toiletry kit, my go pack, and a pair of running shoes in there. And I was very proud of myself, because for me, that was a heck of an accomplishment. And Underscore, I think he was wearing, you know, sneakers for the week, so he didn't have to have a second pair of shoes. But he had like running clothes. He probably brought a damn kettle for his coffee, for all I know, in this backpack. It's like Santa's freaking bag that he has. It's incredible.
So thanks to our sponsors this week, Away, Aftershocks, and Jamf Now, and we'll talk to you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, 'cause it was accidental.
Accidental.
Oh, it was accidental.
Accidental.
John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, 'cause it was accidental.
Accidental.
Oh, it was accidental.
Accidental.
And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
By the way, for people wondering about the inside jacket pocket thing, Underscore is the first person I saw who had a MacBook One, the little 12-inch MacBook with one USB-C port, literally inside his jacket pocket. Like, this is opens, not up, a joke. Opens up his jacket and takes out a laptop.
Yeah, his wife custom made a pocket. She sewed it on the inside of his jacket that would fit exactly that laptop. And it was amazing. To see somebody, especially like underscore, as you mentioned, like he's so like frustratingly organized all the time. Like he's so like together. And he just like, and everything he does, he makes it look effortless. It's just no big deal. Like totally.
So
like,
true. It's so true.
He has like all the grace in the world. Like just, and so like, he just like, we were standing in line at the last WBC in San Francisco. We were outside the whatever center that was, we had to walk all the way over to get there. And he just like whips this out. Like we were like, oh, we should check that sometime, or, you know, and he's like, oh, I'll check it right now. And he whips out this laptop out of his jacket. We're like, whoa, like, how did you do that? Where did that come from?
It was I think
we've been walking with him, standing in line with him. It's like, you know.
Yeah, we had no idea. And it was like a fleece. It was not like a big winter coat. It was like a light fleece.
Oh, man. I love that guy. But there's certain times that I want to strangle him in the best possible way. And that's one of them. Because it's really, you know what it is about underscore is that he very, very well reflects to me my own failings. But he's like the nicest human being in the world, and so you can't be upset at him because he's the nicest guy ever.
Yeah, like did I ever tell you? My favorite compliment I ever received was I once had sent John Gruber some of my home roasted coffee. He said, "I almost want to say fuck you. This is so good." And that's kind of how it's like when underscore does something awesome, and I'm like, it's almost like he's such a nice guy. Like you can't get mad at him, but you're just like, damn it, why, like, yep, yep, why can, yep, I not, why have I either not thought of that or not gotten it together to do that?
so true.
Just comfort yourself by thinking that, just try to picture in your head underscore like being frustrated at something and getting angry.
I don't think I've ever seen him even mildly like disturbed. Like he's never been particularly angry about anything. Well, in my experience, having known him for several years now, I've never seen him angry, never seen him particularly upset. Sometimes he'll kind of do the exasperated laugh of, oh, well, then's the breaks. But
yeah, right.
he's like the least phased person I've ever seen. And I am somewhat skeptical that he has ever raised his voice for any reason ever.
I believe he has, and I picture that to make me feel better about myself.
The best part of all is he's going to be listening to this at some absurd hour tomorrow morning because he typically bootlegs all this, and he is going to be so deeply embarrassed by this entire conversation, which isn't actually something I should be proud of, but it is making me laugh a little bit. Oh, maybe, man. That's his one flaw. That's the one.
His one flaw, excessive, yep, modesty. Wow, that's yeah. it's like the BS job interview responses. What's your worst? Mm-hmm. What's your, yeah, biggest, what's weakness? Your, well, sometimes I work too hard.
Hard.
Yeah, it's, yeah, like,
oh god, that's incredible.